ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
At a rural picnic spot in the dark, a young man suddenly disappears.
You could nearly say an alien took him away because he's just vanished.
When more clues from that night surface, something doesn't sit right.
It's nonsensical where the stuff is. It's been scattered.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
Is it a murder? Is it someone just gone missing?
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The massive explosion in Bali.
We are very concerned that Australians will be amongst
them. The multinational force led by Australian troops has begun arriving in Dili.
Killed in Indonesia's Aceh province after an initial quake off the island of Sumatra.
Ratifying a major security treaty with Indonesia.
Prime Minister Paul Keating has announced that he will travel to Jakarta to sign the treaty.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese met with the Indonesian President Prabowo Subianto to finalise the agreement.
Our biggest near neighbour is changing before our very eyes. By the middle of this century, Indonesia is forecast to be the world's fourth largest economy. Imagine that.
Before, we just handwriting. Now we change to the high tech.
A lot of interesting things happens in Indonesia, right? It's fast growth for economic, especially in the trade.
Hamish has been in Indonesia, gathering a treasure trove of interviews for Global Roaming.
Geraldine, how lucky are we to have this big neighbour, which is, for the most part, democratic, peaceful, growing, which does seem to want to be our friend, but which is interesting and fascinating and dynamic. That, for me, is the thing, the allure of the Indonesia story.
The youth is ready. We are ready.
Are we changing a lot about the economic and the government?
Very eager to have globalisation.
We're unravelling some of the mysteries of a nation right on our doorstep about which we know so little.
It's Hamish here.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and this is Indonesia Rising from Global Roaming. Well, Hamish, our very popular Indonesia Rising series is ending. And look, it really does seem to have awakened a hunger and a curiosity, I suppose I'd put it like that, among our listeners for more about Indonesia.
Yeah, we've been pretty surprised actually by the quantity, but also the depth and clarity and curiosity that's come forward in your responses. So on this final episode of Indonesia Rising, we've decided to do something a bit different. We're going to share some of your feedback, answer your questions, deal with your criticisms. The feedback touched on everything from economic opportunity to our diplomatic blind spots. Some of you also, a bit like Jerry, describe real struggle in trying to understand Indonesia, but there are also some beautiful personal stories which we are going to share. Let's start with the feedback on language and Indonesia literacy more broadly. Do you want to kick us off,
Yes, Geraldine? This is from Domo Lachlan. I am in awe of the series. Thank you. I first travelled to Indonesia in the mid-80s. It was the start of a lifelong love affair with Indonesia. I even managed to hitchhike onto a gunboat from northern Sulawesi to Kalimantan. I still have my threadbare Indonesia handbook by Bill Dalton, circa 1982. I did manage to pick up passable Bahasa, enough to keep me out of trouble. I've been back close to 20 times, a lot of it drawn by the surf. Most recently, I've been back with my family. My youngest daughter and I spent 6 weeks last year on Nusa Penida and Lombok, introducing her to what I thought were the cultural windows which I still hold dear. She lived there for 6 months working on coral restorations and leaving with the same sentiment for the country. One thing, though, I've noticed over time is how few Australians appear to converse in Bahasa. During the 80s, there were less tourists and the Australians stuck out like the proverbial, but during the 80s and 90s, there'd always be an Australian with a good handle on the language. Keep going, he says.
And this from Joel Backwell. It worries me greatly to see the decline in Australia's Indonesia literacy, not just the decline in students studying Indonesian, but the relative ignorance among some Australians about a modern, contemporary, youthful, tech-savvy Indonesia. I'll be appearing at the Parliamentary Inquiry on Australia's Asia Capability, chaired by Tim Watts MP. Keep up the great work. So Joel did appear at the inquiry, as have so many others. We thought you might be interested to learn they looked at 195 published submissions. They held 11 public hearings. The Lowys reported on it, saying that witness after witness made a simple case that Australia can't keep treating its region as an optional extra. Language learning, cultural literacy, mobility, diaspora knowledge, and regional expertise are not hobbies for enthusiasts. They are sovereign capabilities.
Look, I mean, just a reminder again, between 2004 and 2022, there was a 75% decline in enrolments for Southeast Asian languages. I mean, it is extraordinary dwelling upon this, given that this episode was coming. What does this mean? Yeah. Why is this so?
Do you know that of the more than a million Australian domestic students at Aussie universities, just 486 Year 12 students studied Bahasa Indonesia in 2024. The share of domestic Australian tertiary students studying an Asian language in 24 was 0.76%, so not even 1%.
Yes, and the experts are warning that if on the current trajectory, no Australian schools will be left teaching Bahasa Indonesia by 2031. I mean, you'll probably be able to get separate classes, but it won't be there as a systemic offer.
It just sits in such stark contrast with the growth of the region. Like, I know you query to some extent the growth projections, but even if they're half right, the fact that our interest, even just in the language, is waning does not, I think, accord with the realities of the time. DFAT has pointed out to us that the new budget that's just been announced does commit $11.4 million over 4 years to expanding the Australia-Indonesia Institute, and part of that is the cultural exchange, the grant program, but also Indonesian language education. But there is a huge gap here.
Look, and, you know, I could give you a range of statistics about which universities are doing what, but to me it's that drop, dramatic drop in students seeking it out that I'm sort of letting it dominate my thoughts. Mm. But something really interesting has emerged during this inquiry, the Tim Watts inquiry you're talking about, which I think, Hamish, goes to the heart of the issue. The Education Department, the Commonwealth Department, was asked at the inquiry, were they concerned about the decline of language studies? And they responded, quotes, "We're somewhat agnostic at this moment in terms of languages."
Yeah, it was a question about Asian language specifically.
Very interesting.
But doesn't that say something that even our Federal Education Department is agnostic about this? Isn't that a problem?
It's the loss of interest, the broader loss of interest that I think I'm preoccupied by.
I know you love a bit of Hugh White. Professor Hugh White has also given evidence at this inquiry. He spoke to them back in April, and there's one particular element of what he said, which I think goes to what you're asking, which is that whether there's interest or not, ultimately, we may not have much of a choice as to whether we ignore or engage.
Asia is going to be a multipolar region in a multipolar world. The idea that we can approach our relationships with our region on the basis that those relationships are framed by an international order essentially managed by our allies and essentially in English is, well, very ahistoric. A lot of the biggest and most important and most influential ideas of the next century are going to be developed in Asia and expressed in Asian languages. Our whole business about the Asian century is something which I think we as Australians have to revive and refocus on.
Yes, I mean, of course he's right. It's just that how are we going to do that? And that's what's been preoccupying me.
We're going to continue exploring particularly these language and education dimensions because there's obviously more to this story. So we've also had some really interesting correspondence, Jerry, on the struggle to understand and interpret Indonesia. And in part, I think this has been driven by you because you've been quite open in acknowledging your own struggle.
Well, I have, and I think we had a lovely email. I'm just not quite sure whether we're going to have time to read it, sort of thanking me for not necessarily agreeing with you completely because I was truly a great Indonesiaphile and I became less so, and I've been struggling with it. I've been thinking about it, but it sort of, this series has forced me to think again. But here are some of the emails we've had about what you might call the challenge of struggling with a different culture. Helen McWilliam, I love your program on Indonesia and can't get enough of it. I'll feel a loss, frankly, when you finish it. I lived in Jakarta 1975 to 77, a fascinating time, a fascinating country. Though when I was there, I was always a little on edge. So many different language and cultural and social groups, all squeezed into an enormous city, Jakarta, below sea level. By the way, this is the first time I've contacted podcast or media. Love your work.
Great strike rate for getting on air, by the way, Helen. And how about this, Jerry, from Lucrezia Migliori. I'm an Italian-Australian, and Italy was only united in 1860, so also carries the legacy of a country with multiple languages, multiple identities, and many ways of being. There are parts of Italy that have more in common with Austria and Germany, and parts that have more in common with North Africa. But I really appreciate this series as I lived in Indonesia from 2019 to 20 and found it really difficult to get a grasp on as a nation. Many thanks for illuminating this.
And Henry Porter, again thanking us. I'm one quarter Dutch and one quarter Indonesian, thanks to my mum, who never wanted to talk about her experiences before moving to Australia post-World War II. Quotes, look it up yourself or ask someone else. I'm getting on with things with her vibe. So years later, in listening to Global Roaming, I'm discovering things about both other countries and people and myself. It's a lovely letter, wasn't it?
And from Queenslander, Will Barrett, who writes to us from a hotel bed in Legian in Bali. Thanks, Will. Hamish, again, I have pushback. Indonesia might be on our near doorstep, but being here many times for nearly 20 years and Java, I don't feel any affinity to this country. I'm sorry. I don't know any Indonesian people at home in Queensland and haven't met any either. However, people from the Pacific, PNG, New Caledonia, are living in my community, in nursing homes, on farms. They live among us for 4 years at a time, not Indonesians. Yes, Indonesia may be a big country, but it's not influencing our everyday life unless you count bintang singlets and thongs. I thought what I would do to round out this chapter of the conversation is play you some interviews, just little snippets of interviews with people I met in Palembang in Sumatra, so the southern end of Sumatra. These are people, most of them have studied in Australia. They were at an alumni event from different careers, you know, academics, people working for the government, people in trade, people working in law firms. It starts though with Vera, who's a GP. She studied at Griffith Uni in Australia. Just as a little snapshot of contemporary Indonesia.
In my health sector, because I'm a doctor, I see the people now is getting smart. We do not want our people getting sick. They learn how to change their lifestyle to be a healthy person.
Siapa nama?
Ika.
Ika.
Yes. We have a lot of things happen, especially in the trade. My position right now is foreign trade.
Which countries are exporting to Indonesia? Which countries want to do business in Indonesia?
Malaysia, Singapore, China.
Ika, makasih banyak.
Thank you. So you can speak Bahasa?
Sedikit, sedikit.
My name is Intan.
Where are you from?
From Palembang.
Did you study in Australia as well?
I joined the youth exchange program 2003 in Perth. I have a working experience in hospital in Perth and also in a small city in Geraldton.
Wow, that must have been a culture shock for you.
I like a bule when I was landed in Indonesia after the program.
Bule is what Indonesians call a foreigner, right?
Foreigner, yes.
Brown hair and a blue eyes. Bule. Like you, bule.
How do you describe the change that you're seeing in Indonesia?
An education changing. The student don't have to bring a lot of books, so the student only have an iPad. Language could be Indonesian, also English.
I'm Ari. I'm in-house lawyer.
What is it that makes young Indonesians so optimistic then?
We are so adaptable, so Indonesian people is very ready actually.
Okay. Terima kasih banyak.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
Terima kasih banyak.
Thank you very much.
My name is Sri. I'm an English lecturer.
Do you think young Indonesians are more outward looking?
Yes, yes, yes.
What about culturally? See a lot of them on TikTok, a lot of them talking about Instagram, smoking, drinking. This is kind of new.
Students, we have to give them the barriers.
Do you worry about brain rot?
Yes, of course.
Makasih banyak.
Terima kasih. Sudah makan pempek?
Sudah makan pempek, yeah. What is pempek?
So that's kind of fish cake. When I was in Australia, I sell pempek, you know. And then some friends enjoy it very much.
So where did you sell the pempek?
In Adelaide, in Flinders University.
Makasih.
Sama-sama.
I wanted to play you some of those voices because I think it's really hard as an outsider to describe to Australia just how dynamic and vibrant and young and optimistic and kind of energized Indonesia felt to me. And I know that's one particular cohort they've obviously been privileged to study in Australia. But everywhere I went, I was finding these really lovely, funny, dynamic, curious people. And I know you often ask me, like, how interested in the outside world are they? And that is what really shone through to me. That desire to be part of a region and a world and to have a seat at the table.
Well, you see, I almost never found that. I'm sorry to say that. It's the same
in
India.
You don't ask enough questions.
Well, maybe I don't.
You know.
Well, yes. Look, I think that they – I loved that man who said they're very adaptable because I think that is true.
He had worked at the Supreme Court of New South Wales. That's where he did his legal training.
Right. But he wanted to go back to Indonesia.
They all want to go back and, you know, build their country. It's quite something and it does stand out. You're listening to Global Roaming. This is the final episode of our Indonesia Rising series where we're answering your questions, dealing also with some of your criticisms about blind spots in the coverage. Do you want to introduce Kevin Holmes'
feedback? I do. You successfully gave us a great oversight, says Kevin, into modern Indonesia. I do wish, however, that you had not cut your speaker off when she began to talk about the podcasts on everyday relationship problems, because outside of the wealthy, educated, middle-class Indonesia, there is a cauldron of struggle and suffering and fear. I'm not sure how you can tap into that, or even if you should, as it's a dark story. But still, it might pay you, Hamish, to learn to leave the flesh pots of Jakarta and hang out where people do not go jogging.
Well, I hope, Kevin, that you appreciate that snapshot from Palembang in Sumatra, quite away from Java. But look, it's a fair point. And I thought actually, Jerry, I'd introduce Bonnie Triana at this point in the conversation. He's an historian turned politician. He represents the PDIP, so not to go too much into the weeds of it, but a centre-left, popular, secularist, nationalist party. It's the party that's currently led by Megawati Sukarnoputri, the former president, daughter of Sukarno, of course. And I got talking to him when I was there at the parliament about this disparity between Jakarta and the rest of the country.
So in my constituency, not too far from here, only one and a half hour by train.
West Java, right?
In Banten. Banten. You know, you can find a farmer who only get 20,000 rupiah. That's, I think, less than $2 Australia per day. And he has three children, and you know, I believe he's not the only one. And it means we not only need the political democracy, but also economical democracy. So in my dream, someday Indonesia will be a egalitarian.
That's Bonnie Triana there, who you're going to hear a little bit more from later in this episode. We also had some feedback from Michael Brindley in Richmond, Victoria. With all this talk of Indonesia, he says, changes, alliances, neighbours, etc., there is scant attention, if any, to what Indonesia is doing so ruthlessly in West Papua. Is it East Timor again? Is it taboo to discuss this? I bet I'm not the first to ask. We did actually deal with that particular query in one of the previous episodes, but I thought worth noting, Geraldine, as well, that we also heard correspondence from some Australian Indonesians who said it's actually a mistake to think it's the same story as East Timor. The history is very different. It's very complex. Obviously, there are some terrible things that have happened, continue to happen in West Papua. It's not easy to summarise, but it is not, I think, a replicable you know, apples for apples story.
Look, one of the things that I think is truly fascinating about Indonesia is the vastness of it and the fact that it does hold together so well. They're immensely proud of Pancasila, the governing...
The five principles.
The five principles. They're immensely proud of Indonesia. Very, I think, I found patriotic. And one of the challenges, and they know it, is incorporating the different cultures like West Papua and, you know, other parts of Sumatra, for goodness sake.
I suppose the point is ethnically very different. It also has a different history because it had declared its own independence in 1961 and then was annexed by Indonesia in 1969. And obviously there are still instances of violence, even as I was there recently.
That's right. And there's the whole issues of transmigrasi, you know, bringing people from other parts of Indonesia there, the role of the army and so on. It's not a nice, easy story. We know that. So we're not going to sort of demean it now by quickly going into it. But it's on the radar for us, believe you me. And we always sort of work out and we're trying to sort of plan our programs ahead. But look, I think it's probably is time to look at the Indonesia history story on our episode with historian David Van Reybroek, whose book Revolusi invites, I think you could say, sort of reconsideration of Indonesia's pathway to independence and really the whole significance of Indonesia in world history.
If you would have had the chance to travel through Indonesia in the late 1930s, you would have a hard time believing that this region, this colony, was going to be a free, independent country in a couple of years' time and becoming the fourth most populous country in the world. It was fragmented. Dutch colonial authorities did everything to keep things apart. There was a bit of a beginning of a national language, but it was only in the late 1920s that activists started to campaign for Bahasa Indonesia as the national language. I mean, the archipelago is the biggest in the world. It's 1/8 of the equator is Indonesia. This was not experienced as a country. This was an archipelago with so many different languages, so many different cultural identities. It's nothing short of a miracle that a national identity and a national state was created out of this diversity.
Well, that's David Van Reybroek, the Belgian historian there. If you missed that episode, do go and find it in your podcast feed because it had heaps of response from you, our wonderful listeners, including this from Anne Richter. And I've got to say, Anne, thank you so much. This was just delightful to read. She says, I was rather excited that the author of Revolusi would be giving the keynote address at the 2025 Ubud Writers Festival in Bali. Although the festival attracts international visitors, especially writers from a diversity of countries, Indonesian writers, journalists, intellectuals, activists, students, and young people generally have increased their presence enormously in recent years. They were emotionally overwhelmed by Van Reybroek's address and his contributions to discussion panels. I overheard one young woman who was almost in tears say to her friends, I never understood that my country's history is so important. I suspect, says Anne, that the book has and will continue to influence how younger Indonesians see their past, future and place in the world. Australians would benefit a great deal from reading it too and would also be guaranteed of a gripping read.
But now President Prabowo, he's actually trying to capitalise on this a bit, isn't he?
Well, I wouldn't say capitalise. There's sort of multiple revisions going on at the moment. So under Prabowo, they're trying to rewrite the formal national history. And what's controversial about this is that they're removing some of the darker chapters that exist since independence. So think about the crackdown on the communists, essentially Indonesian gulags, even the lead up to the end of the New Order regime, in which Prabowo himself as a military general is implicated. Some of those chapters are being removed. And what's so fascinating is that that's happening concurrently with this more broad societal revision of Indonesian history, which is being provoked by David Van Reybroek. David actually introduced me to Bonnie Triana, this historian turned politician that I mentioned. And so I talked about this with him, comparing the way people write history, who gets to control it, who dictates the narrative, because this is such a fascinating moment for Indonesia.
That's a problem of a post-colonial country. You know, we free from the Dutch 8 years ago, which is actually not long. Mm. You know? But coloniality, something that still stays, mm-hmm. They're still reading
its shadow. Its shadow looms.
Yeah.
Look, I think the business of vexed history is so interesting. And Graham Isaac wrote us, it's a longish letter, but I think it's really worth listening to because it pertains to us as well. Geraldine mentioned in passing, writes Graham, the role of the Australian waterside workers' strike, which impeded the re-entry of the Dutch into the Dutch East Indies after the Japanese surrender. But there was also a second interesting Australian intervention, an Australian diplomatic mission that took place 1 month later in October 1945, when Evatt, who was then the Attorney General, and Chifley, the Prime Minister, ignored British and Dutch advice and sent a two-man Australian diplomatic mission to Batavia, Jakarta, to find out what was going on in Indonesia for themselves. The key person drafted to lead the mission was William McMahon Ball, an ex-ABC radio broadcaster and academic, who in 1945 had become the head of the School of Politics at Monash. His assistant was my father, Joe Isaac, a young economist who'd been brought up in Java and Penang and had the languages and cultural knowledge to support the mission. Together, despite the antipathy of the Dutch, the annoyance of the British and the indifference of the Americans, they met in Batavia with Sukarno and his cabinet, making Australia the first country to have a delegation recognise and meet them. Before my father died, I recorded his account of the mission and was later asked by DFAT to make a short film about it for the Australian Embassy in Jakarta to be part of a travelling exhibition in Indonesia. Can I just very quickly say, Hamish, this whole story of Indonesia very much affected our Australian developmental story, politically and culturally, because the waterside workers in the Seamen's Union, who led those black bands, they were very populated by the Communist Party of Australia.
Right.
And that became a huge issue, leading to a major referendum in 1951 to outlaw the Communist Party, which Prime Minister Menzies lost, just, and it changed him forever. So
I didn't know any of this.
I know. Well, I did a story about it. In fact, if people want to go to it, years ago, I did a documentary called The Party Over, which I actually just found again recently. It is actually online. So this dominated our politics big time, crushing the communist tendency, shall I say, a massive civil war within the Labor Party, which had a long, long-term impact. And a lot, you know, that was heavily affected by their interest in Indonesia.
Well, we are running out of time for this episode. We've also received a bunch of emails about the economic opportunity, the growth trajectories, what that means for Australia, how we're delivering on the recommendations of the Nicholas Moore report. I think what we might do, Geraldine, is we have made contact with Nicholas Moore. There's also this Tim Watts-led parliamentary inquiry. So our plan is to circle back onto some of those specifics in the coming weeks and months. So we might leave that component of this for now, because we've had a lot of information and a lot of research done with DFAT and the Export Finance Australia for some of the kind of nuts and bolts of what's going on between Australia and the region, and we'll look forward to sharing that with you in the future. But maybe just to round things out for this episode, Geraldine, when we were chatting the other day, you mentioned something that this whole series had provoked for you, a memory of a teacher.
Oh, it certainly did. I said to you, why have we lost so much interest? And, you know, I went back and looked. In October 2012, Australia, under Julia Gillard, the Prime Minister, brought out that white paper, Australia and the Asian Century, that we'd be, you know, sort of fundamentally leading in our Asia literacy and so on. It hasn't happened. Do we need a conscious leadership by the government of the day in that way to draw us in? I don't know, but I am wondering.
Do we need leaders that are passionate about it?
That's right. I wonder if, I mean, I don't
I wonder
think
if
we,
they're there.
We all, well, they may not be, but why do we need that type of leadership? It's just a very interesting conundrum I'm left with.
Thanks to all of our producers on the Indonesia Rising series, Kylie Gray, Jesse Kay, Aston Brown. Original music by Samuel Phelps. Our executive producer is Kylie Morris. Waleed and I will be back tomorrow. Looking forward to Donald Trump's 80th birthday, Geraldine. Do you want to know? in Bahasa, until next time, sampai nanti.
Oh,
come on.
Terima kasih.
Okay, have a go at it.
What is it?
Sampai nanti.
Sampai nanti, Hamish.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.